Let's talk about sax. Let's talk about sax. Welcome to the show, everyone. My name is Jeff Robinson. Let's talk about sax is our podcast here. Let's talk about sax.com is the website. We're going to continue our series with Charlie Parker and Chuck Haddix, who wrote the book on Charlie Parker, ladies and gentlemen. The Life and Music of Charlie Bird Parker by Chuck Haddix. Second part of the interview is coming right up. Yes, yes, let's talk about sax. Come on, y'all. All right, let's segue right into that interview. Let's do that. Let's segue right into the second part. When I did my play, I met Doris and Kim through the play. One of the things they both said, and it's in your book, is Charlie Parker practiced like a maniac. He practiced a lot all the time. When the opportunity came, he would, and a lot of people had, they thought that it was just a natural thing. In that Paul Desmond interview, when he says, you know, he would practice 15 hours a day and the neighbors were ready to throw his mother out of the place because he was practicing so much. And Paul Desmond admits it, he was startled. He thought that it was just natural. Charlie Parker put in the time on his instrument, though you can tell it was definitely a gifted musician that heard things differently than other musicians, but he did practice. Did anyone else share any experiences with you about how much time he put on his horn or how he may have done it?
Well, I think that in reaction to, I think he spent a lot of time on his horn because, and when he was humiliated by Joe Jones at the Reno Club, he said, that will never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he began to master his horn.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like any great artist, you want to make your art better. And then, mm-hmm. and he loved to play.
Mm-hmm.
And so he practiced regularly, and mm-hmm. you know, he woodshedded. Played all summer long, 1936, down in the Ozarks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, throughout his career, he practiced. Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm.
And he, I'm, you know, you hear all kinds of great stories about him. Luc von Hamsa talked about how seeing Bird walk through the neighborhood with his horn in a bag.
Yeah, I heard about that one.
And you know, he was a consummate musician, and he, you know, it was art. He made art, you know.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that's interesting too is how much he inspired artists.
Mm-hmm.
Not just sculptors, but writers, poets.
Yeah.
You know, and how his art inspired other artists.
Yeah, there's a lot of documentation about Jack Kerouac being heavily influenced by Charlie Parker and his free-flowing style of writing. And you know, he wrote a couple of poems about Charlie Parker and mentions him in his work. And, you know, they were... Jack Kerouac kind of came to age right around the time Charlie Parker passed away, honestly. So.
Well, you know, think about Kerouac seeing Bird in San Francisco, you know, when the beats are, the beat movement's just emerging there, and along comes Bird, who leads the bebop.
Mm-hmm.
And for what Kerouac and those guys were doing for literature, what Bird had done for music.
Right.
You know, his influence is often underestimated. I always say that there's music before Bird and there's music after Bird. He's a transitional figure, and it's not, he didn't just change jazz, he changed music.
I agree.
You know, it's like, he was like Mozart that way.
I agree with you 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's unfortunate he didn't live longer, because who knows if he settled down what he could have done, you know, for classical music. You know, he always loved classical music. And there's a lot of ironies in his life. You know, his string recordings were his most successful recordings financially. But taking on the string group, he lost his lost his quartet.
Right.
His jazz group, you know.
Right.
Red Rodney couldn't work with strings, so Red Rodney drifted off. So that forced him to travel as a solo act, using backup musicians, and let's face it, it's, you know, the A team playing with the B team all across the country, and fueled his frustration.
Yeah, yeah, you can hear it on some of the recordings too. That you know, some of the bootleg recordings from that time. You know, the quality of his McDowell.
And then, you know, and today, if he were alive today, he'd be teaching probably at Juilliard or Berkeley.
Yeah,
you know, and he didn't have that luxury. He always was a working musician. And, you know, when you know, it gets old playing in bars, musicians quickly learn, and a lot of my friends, you know, have learned this lesson, that playing in bars gets to be old, you know, and I think that's one of his attractions to classical music was, you know, the concert halls and, you know, playing in concert halls, and he felt it elevated his music. He's a fascinating individual, that's for sure.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, Jeff.
No, the swing was more of a dance music, and Charlie Parker and him and Dizzy Gillespie, and others, Bud Powell, and they sort of made it more of a listening music, and I think the concert hall, you know, when he got into Carnegie Hall and places like that, where he really appreciated where there's not really a dance floor here, there are people will have to sit down and listen. I think it took people a while to understand what was going on. The whole California and Camarillo, experiment, when they went out to California, him and Dizzy, to bring the music out there, and it was not successful, initially. Says a lot about that transition of trying to bring this into a listening environment, almost a chamber music environment, very much like classical music. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I would. You know, if you think about the jazz at Massey Hall, you know, and you listen to those recordings, the band is soaring.
Yeah, they really
are. You know, because it's got this wonderful venue, this wonderful platform to soar from. You know, and his concert recordings are just, you know, they're transcendent. You know, you listen to them in the clubs, it's a whole different thing.
That's true.
You know, and that whole thing of having to, you know, make a, you know, he never had the luxury of being an artist who had the time to make his art. He was always hustling for money.
That's true.
You know, to feed his habit, to support his family, you know, and he was robbed artistically of his compositions. In some instances, that was self-inflicted. But, you know, one of the things about his estate is you know, there's not much there because he didn't, you know, take care of his publishing. You know, and, you know, copyright things.
Yeah, that's true.
Minka said, you know, if Bird was a gunslinger, there'd be a lot of dead copies. You know?
Exactly. Everybody, him a little bit of some money. That was another quote. Yeah, I can't remember that. But bringing up his estate, now the estate is, Charlie Parker's estate is under much better management, and some great things are happening. I just got, I just saw online that there's a graphic novel coming out about Charlie Parker and his time in California. I think that's wonderful. And quite a few other things are coming out. So I think they're still, because of the monies that he didn't handle his business right, and he married quite a few women without divorcing them when he moved on to marry the next wife. Just really messed up his estate. But it sounds like they're trying to turn it around, and I believe they have turned it around a great deal.
Yeah, he you know, ironically, his estate has an advocate now. When he was alive, he didn't really have an advocate.
Mm.
Although I would have to say that Norman Granz did look after Byrd and mm-hmm. did take care of Byrd,
mm-hmm.
and you know, featured him on Jazz at the Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I think when it came to Norman Granz, there was always that struggle for his, when his Verve recordings, when he recorded for Verve and when Norman produced his recordings, that Norman had an idea of what he wanted Byrd to do, and he would pick the sidemen.
Right.
You know, and Byrd didn't have the creative freedom that he had on his own, but he had the structure, and you know, Norman doesn't get enough credit. You know, you can tell the kind of relationship that Norman and Byrd had when Byrd talks about how he was the most miserable millionaire I think he's ever met. And it was Norman that would make the money off jazz, not the musicians, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it came at a cost, you know, to him. You know, he wouldn't let him work with the drummer he wants to work with, Roy Haynes.
Right, I've read that,
he would always, you know, Byrd wanted to use Roy Haynes, and Norman wanted to use the other musician. So it came at a creative cost to success with Norman.
Right. Roy Haynes is still alive, praise God. And Sonny Rollins and Kansas City Jazz is still thriving. I did my play there, you know, a couple of years back in the festival that you have and the section where Count Basie and all those guys were playing is a museum area now. How is that going now? What is the name of that area now? Does it have a name?
It's 18th and Vine, the 18th and Vine Historic District, mm-hmm. and it has the American Jazz Museum and the Negro Baseball Museum,
mm-hmm.
and they're thriving. They're doing well. The American Jazz Museum has a new director, Rashida Phillips.
Right.
And she's a jazz vocalist, and she's doing some wonderful things. In fact, mm-hmm. I'm working with Rashida and the archivist, Jerry Sanders, there, in creating an exhibit on Charlie Parker for this year's centennial celebration. So
mm-hmm.
I've been spending my time, I'm co-curating it with Jerry, and we're going to use material from their collections and from UMKC and from the Norman Sachs collection and Rutgers to create a 12-panel exhibit on Charlie Parker's life, and also show some of the memorabilia that we have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have his saxophone. We have saxophones there,
right?
You know, show that. And recently, we came across one of Byrd's reeds in a collection. You know, we've got recordings that he did here in Kansas City. So, you know, it's going to be nice working with them. And you know, it's been you know, the Mutual Musicians Foundation is still operating, although they're shut down now because of the coronavirus.
Right.
And musicians still gather there and jam all night long. And you know, the tradition in Kansas City is passed from older musicians to younger musicians. That's the way it always has been.
Yeah.
And that's still happening here. And plus, you know, there's a lot of clubs. There's the Green Lady Lounge and
That's where I did my playing. Yeah.
The Black Dolphin.
Yep.
Incidentally, you should talk to John Scott because he has the Blue Dolphin now, the Black Dolphin, excuse me, and it has a nice stage.
Yeah, and it's right next to his other club. I know we've talked about bringing the play back. You know, I was going to be there during this year, the centennial for the festival. You know, just like everything, it's got slowed down. When I first did my play there, which was a good while back now, I remember these gentlemen. I met Buck O'Neill, who I'll never forget meeting Buck O'Neill. He loved the play, and I wasn't sure who he was because I hadn't done my research to that extent. And then someone pulled me aside and told me, That man is a legend, and you better get his autograph. And I did. But they took me to this room that wasn't far. I did it at the Gem Theater, and they told me it was the African American Union Room, Union Hall.
And that's local. That's Mutual Musicians Foundation.
Yeah, they gave me a T-shirt and everything, and I could, I felt the history in the room. That room is still there, is it not?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Oh, that's
where it all comes from. That's where it all flows from. Is the foundation. There's a lot of history there. We have that collection at the university, all the photos from the Mutual Musicians Foundation. And I work with them, doing programs too. They're going to be participating in the centennial again this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's also, of course, the Black Archives and the Alvin Ailey dance group is there at 18th and Vine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city, put a lot of money in it, and it's been slow coming around as a tourist destination, but it's getting there even quicker now these days.
That's great.
Yeah. And the American Jazz Museum is, I've been working with them very closely and enjoying that association.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I went there, a couple of, maybe like 4 years ago or something like that, my wife and I, just for another reason, we happen to be in Kansas City, and you know they have that great, you know, bust statue of Charlie Parker in the back there, and you know it looks like he's in mid-riff, though it's just his head. And for people who know who Charlie Parker, they get it. You know, they get that. I'm wondering, for people who don't really know who Charlie Parker is or understood his majesty, has there been any debate on that statue, that bust that is back behind the museum?
Well, you know, there's a movement now to move it to the corner of 18th and Vine,
mm-hmm.
by the mm-hmm. Jazz Museum, and to right. and to put a spotlight on it, because it's on parkland now, and so you don't really see it.
You don't.
And so they want to bring that forward. And actually, for this year's centennial celebration, we're going to do the 21 sack salute at statue.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Previously, it's always been at the
gravesite
at Lincoln Cemetery, but I think it's better to do it at 18th and Vine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you know, be respectful of the grave. You know, that celebration has been going on for years. It started with Eddie Baker, who had the Charlie Parker Foundation.
Right.
And then Ahmed Al-Adin continued that tradition. But it's been a year or so since we've done anything out at the cemetery. So this year, I think I'm going to do a walking tour with Jake Wagner, professor at UMKC of historic sites associated with Byrd. And then there'll be a 21 sack salute, keeping it 18th and Pine. You know, I felt a real connection with Byrd because of all the people that I knew that knew Byrd.
Right.
On his birthday, a number of years back, I was with Step Buddy Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And Step Buddy took me to 19th and Vine in front of the old Kentucky Barbecue and showed me where Byrd first met Gillespie and told me the story and how he introduced him.
Right.
And how they walked around the corner to the Union and Byrd and Buddy played for Dizzy. Dizzy didn't play for him. And this was in the summer in July.
Right.
And, you know, the Callaway Band had been out at Fairyland Park. And this is where bebop was born, because it's where they first met.
Right.
And so, you know, I've always had this connection here in Kansas City and all these, because I always hung out with the musicians when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
I used to hang out with the old guys. Now I am the old guy. and Piggy Miner was the sweetest man you ever met. I knew John Jackson too.
Mm.
There's all these legends about Byrd, and you know, the research goes on. I'm still researching Byrd and finding out new stuff, and I'm going to incorporate those into the exhibit we're doing at the American Jazz Museum.
That's great. How is the festival coming along considering the circumstances with this virus?
It's coming along. You know, there's KCPT, I think, is going to be doing a documentary on Bird. We're making plans, but, you know, unfortunately, things are so uncertain. You don't know how long social distancing is going to last.
Right.
And so we have to have contingency plans, let's put it that way.
Right.
And one way or another, we will celebrate him.
Yeah.
You know, it could be that, you know, we will be celebrating in the fall. We'll be celebrating the fall, too, because maybe there'll be some easing of social restriction. But,
right.
You know, this whole plague is just like, you know, put a real wrench in the works, shall we say, celebration.
It has. And it's been, you know, obviously I have respect and love for Charlie Parker, you know, from the same state, and saxophone, he's influenced me from the very beginning of playing the saxophone. And, you know, thinking about 2020 for a good while now and thinking, okay, it's finally here. Here's his time to, you know, get a little more respect and exposure to some people who may not know who he is or who he was. And then this comes along. It's refreshing and inspiring to know that Kansas City is still figuring out a way to celebrate this great artist that came out of Kansas City, you know, and one of the greatest artists in the history of this world, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of respect for Bird here. If you call Bobby Watson up, you get Bird playing April in Paris on his answering machine.
There you go.
You know, Bird, as we say, Bird lives.
Yeah, he does. He really does. And Bobby Watson's another great Kansas City saxophonist.
Oh, yeah. He's a keeper of the flame, really. When he taught at the conservatory, just retired, he attracted some of the brightest and best young musicians from across the country.
Mm-hmm.
They came to the conservatory to study with Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
And he really elevated that program. And now he's thinking about his legacy. And I talked to him just the other day, and he was doing an arrangement.
Wow. I'd love to talk to Bobby.
To write arrangements, yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to get him on this podcast at some point.
But Bobby's a great guy.
Yeah.
He's good hang.
Yeah, I've never met him. I got some friends who know him, and I remember his days with Art Blakey that really, you know, pushed him over the top. Great, great musician. I'd love to talk to him at some point. I'm gonna have to ask you to do the hookup sometime, Chuck.
Well, I will. And you know, as far as the celebration this year, like I said, when the Black Dolphin gets open, you know, I talked to John McGraw at a centennial meeting, and we're meeting virtually, and he said that, you know, that John Scott was very interested in talking to you about participating and doing the one-man show at the Black Dolphin.
Yeah, we had talked about it. We had, and that was going to be the place to perform it. And it's, you know, it's much better than the lady, Green Lady. It's much, the sight lines, there are very few distractions and seeing what's on stage. So, we had it all set up. And again, the situation, the virus shut it down. So, you know, when things, John knows where to find me, and I'll give him a call. He knows where to find me. I'm very whenever I've performed the play in a lot of different spots, like Kansas City, New York, some colleges. No audience has been so receptive to the play than Kansas City. It's just, I love when I'm there. I feel like I'm home, you know?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, when you come to town, we'll hook up and I'll show you some historic sites on Bird. One of the things that I was doing the research for the book, the 1930 census was released, and there was always this, you know, shorthand version of Charlie Parker's life in Kansas City as a child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he went from, Freeman to, 1516 Olive, you know. And in reality, you know, he lived and went to school in a white section of town.
Wow.
We were able to identify through school records and through census, identify two residences in Midtown where he lived with his family,
mm-hmm.
and the fact that he went to Penn School, which is in Westport.
Right.
You know, and there was this little enclave of African American community there, and he was part of that. And I had the opportunity to talk to people he went to grade school with at Penn School, and get greater insight into what Bird was like as a young person and in those very formative years.
Mm-hmm.
That had not been covered at all, and that's one of the things that I was really pleased to include in my book.
I was pleased to read it because a lot of that information I had never read and never even thought about, you know, when you honestly, because, you know, people kind of start at the moment the symbol was thrown, you know, but there's all this build up before that, like, you know, like his mother had bought him a saxophone. Well, he was 7 or something like that. Was that the age?
He was in fifth grade when he first started playing saxophone. That's when Kansas City School District introduced music program at Penn School.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where he first picked up the horn. I got that from his talking to a couple of his friends from that era.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one that was an architect, and they had very distinct memories about Charlie. And that's the part of his story that had never really been told, that, you know, most biographers concentrated, particularly Ross Russell, on his the more sensational aspects of his life, his music, not him as a man.
Right.
You know, and he had been wrapped in myths, and one of my goals was to strip away the myths, to tell the true story, his true story.
Yeah.
That's what I wanted to do.
Oh, you achieved it. You know, it's definitely there, and I recommend anyone who's listening to this podcast, the name of the book is Bird, The Life and Music of Charlie Parker by Charles.
Not Chuck Addicts. I don't do Charles.
Okay, I wanted. I thought that I went too far there. I'm sorry. I kind of censored myself there at that moment.
The only people that call me Charles are my mother and my wife, usually when they're mad at me. All right, listen, Jeff, it's been good talking to you, man.
You too. Thanks so much.
All right, we'll be in touch, and I'll keep you informed on what's happening here. I think you've got the latest notes from the Centennial Committee, so
I do.
Keep you posted.
Thank you for sending those.
And let me know how I can help. Okay.
I will. I definitely will. I really appreciate you talking to me.
Let's talk about sax. That was a fun interview with Chuck Addicts, author of The Life and Music of Charlie Parker. Charlie Bird Parker. Fun talking to him. Very grateful. Took the time out to talk about sax and Charlie Parker being arguably the greatest saxophonist ever. In an earlier podcast, I said that Adolph Sax was the greatest saxophonist ever. Yes, they both are. We have a website, letstalkaboutsax.com. I'd like to thank Reactor Productions for this theme song. Oh, I love it. Let's listen to it some more. Like to thank Anchor for podcast distribution. Also like to thank Levitate Web Solutions for producing the podcast. I'm gonna add a little addendum about Chuck Haddock's web presence, and get to the next part of this series on Charlie Parker, going to Kim Parker, Charlie Parker's daughter. Had a nice interview with her. She's up next. Let's talk about sex, everyone.